Welcome back to our spin-off series, Let's Talk About. I am Eleana, and together with Anastasia, we are the hosts of this series. In today's episode, we are going to dive into the subject of misinformation in science. We all have experienced, probably multiple times in our lives, receiving incorrect information about, for example, the benefits of eating certain foods or some medical symptoms. We might have even been the source of sharing incorrect information. Whether out of lack of understanding or whether some people can do this out of malice, this is a common issue in our societies.
Yeah, it's especially relevant to topics which are new or unfamiliar to us. And on top of that, we live in a fast-paced world. There's a lot of information being thrown at us, and we have to try just to make sense of it all.
Exactly. And to help us understand and break down this topic, we are joined by Tiffany Duke, a senior advisor at Cochrane, overseeing all the global Cochrane centers. For those who may not know, Cochrane is a non-profit organization where professionals make systematic reviews on the health-related research topics. Apart from working in Cochrane, Tiffany is a registered dietitian and nutritionist, holding a master's in public health and being an expert in global health and maternal child malnutrition. It is her role as a spokesperson for evidence synthesis and infodemics misinformation and advocacy for trial transparency that made her the ideal guest for today's episode. Welcome, Tiffany, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Maybe to jump into already the episode, we can start with the simplest question. What is misinformation? And what is the difference between misinformation and disinformation?
Great question. Misinformation, which you covered a little bit in your introduction, is usually incorrect information or overwhelming information or multiple different types of information about the same subject, which are contradictory or confusing. So misinformation is often due to carelessness or lack of research of what people say, or sharing information that they haven't checked the source of, just kind of spreading information that they may think is true, or they just haven't really checked a good source. Disinformation is a more intentional, purposeful way to misinform people. So you may be purposely choosing information that you may know is untrue because you want your population or your listeners or your readers to believe what you say. And there are many reasons for that. They could be political, or they could be monetary, economic, they could just be reputation. But there, unfortunately, is disinformation as well. I would say the majority of information that's not true or truthful is misinformation, but there is also disinformation.
I have to be honest about this, because before I started preparing about this episode, I had no idea that these were two different things. For me, I had one term, misinformation, and that was like the umbrella term for everything in my head. So it's very interesting, and I guess also for our audience, to realize that there are actually many different categories along this line. And I didn't know, but we did experience it a lot, especially in the recent years, from the political scene, but also the media, exactly what disinformation is. But misinformation is also something we all, as I said in the intro, might do accidentally in our everyday life.
Exactly.
Actually, I think I heard the first time the term disinformation during the COVID crisis. And I guess that's very relevant to what you do as well.
Yes, I think that might be when I first heard it as well. I was familiar with some of the other terminology, just having worked in health communications and public health. But disinformation was a new term for me too. And it's not a great one to learn. It's just we all know that it happens, but it's unfortunate that it happens enough that there's an entire terminology around people who purposely misinform the public.
And I guess over this time of crisis, it really just put this out there. So it's always been there, but this really emphasized its presence.
Absolutely. And on a global scale.
Right. For me, it's the magnitude with which this is happening. And this is very shocking. So we've seen it a lot, as Anastasia commented, the current years with the COVID pandemic. But how exactly does misinformation and disinformation spread?
Good question, Eliana. It can spread in a multitude of ways. And I think as technology and international travel progress and become more accessible to more people around the globe, there's more ways for information to be spread. So certainly the internet is one. People go to websites or newspaper articles or social media and find anyone from a doctor to their neighbor giving information about any topic under the sun. And some may seem more credible than others. You know, a doctor, a medical website, and I put air quotes around that for the listeners, may seem credible over your next door neighbor talking about something health related. But in reality, there's no way to know unless you really do some background research on which of those is credible. Also, especially over the past few years with the global pandemic, people spread a lot of misinformation through WhatsApp, through phones, through text messaging, Facebook messaging, especially WhatsApp. It was actually one of the biggest offenders of the spread of misinformation worldwide was the use of WhatsApp, because it's used on a global scale. It's easy to forward things and it sounds personal. You get a message that says, my aunt's neighbor saw this. It's true. And it seems true when you get it, but it's really been forwarded 500 times. So those sources are no longer traceable. But it's also spread through print media, through the radio, especially through television. People are watching 24-hour news channels. And I'm sure other countries are similar to the U.S. where news channels have gotten very political. So a very conservative news channel is going to give you very different information from a very liberal news channel. And it's very hard to know where the truth lies. So yeah, word of mouth and all kinds of media are the main sources of spread of information.
Yeah, I kind of suspected media and social media in particular. We have seen it heavily happening on Twitter, for example, or at least I am fully aware of it happening on Twitter.
Absolutely.
But I've never thought about the WhatsApp, because I understand what you say. It's like the platform where we all message our friends. We are part of group chats and we might say, oh, you know, I read this, or, you know, this person I know and I trust told me this. And then this information can be passed on and on and on, kind of like we call it broken telephone line in Greece.
I
think
letter.
This is So, but I had not thought of it before.
In my case, I think what I noticed in many different media is that creators, like it can be news channels or it can be somebody on a YouTube or anyone really, like they really are in desperate need for attention, because that's how they earn money. That's how they bring viewers, readers, listeners. And of course, they need to deliver some like spicy or controversial news, often with clickbaiting. And basically like delivering what public wants. And in this way, they are also creating this a lot of misinformation, because people, they're looking for facts that they want to see and sort of like have this been approved by someone else that they can like with clear conscience just go and do the way they actually wanted to do anyways, without any expert opinion. So that I think is a very big part of this.
That's absolutely true. Anyone can say anything on any platform about any topic. And like you said, Anastasia, we are in a moment in time where it's kind of like, give the people what they want. And if the truth is boring, then gotta, you know, spin it a little bit.
Exactly. And that is what politicians take advantage of, because they have their followers who have certain backgrounds, certain ideologies, and their politicians just feed them the information they want to hear, whether it's right or wrong. They won't care so long they keep their followers on their, or, you know, behind them. But to me, it has always been very strange because, of course, being a scientist myself, I have learned that whenever I read an article or hear something, I will search, what's the source of this? Where did they get their information? And then I will try to dig deeper and deeper and deeper until I find an official statement from some medical organization or some scientific research to back that claiming. But that's not something everyone is familiar with.
What you describe is a very much scientific method of analyzing information. Like, we were just taught from the very beginning, like from our bachelors, to be very skeptical. And I think it's really ingrained in our professions to always question your results and always double, triple check things.
Yes, it's very personal on exactly what your education or lifestyle or culture has instilled in you about information, and it can vary wildly from one group of people to the next. And I completely agree. I've, as a scientist, of course, like, what's the source? Check the source, double check the source, check the source's source. But that's certainly not something you can expect from the public who have not been, you know, educated as scientists. That certainly, you know, wouldn't be something you would expect most people to understand.
Just time-wise, because there are so many things going on, it's impossible for us to keep on track with everything and check in every single thing.
Absolutely. You want to trust the expert. You don't want to have to go do the digging yourself all the time. You say, okay, you are the doctor. You tell me what's the truth here. And we said a little bit how now there is all this different avenues through which information and misinformation can spread. So this means that misinformation is, and disinformation as well, is something that is way more abundant today.
Correct. Yes. And so many of your listeners are probably familiar with the term infodemic, which was coined actually back in 2006, but not publicly and globally used until recently during the COVID pandemic, when WHO declared a simultaneous infodemic, which is a pandemic of overinformation and misinformation specifically. And WHO put a call to action to the global public health and scientific community, medical community, to help mitigate that infodemic by, you know, promising to be as truthful as possible and only share valid and sourced information. But I think it just became kind of a buzzword too. So it just became synonymous with these giant waves of information that just wash over things and kind of take over the truth, that you have to look so hard to find the truth. And like both of you mentioned, A, you don't have the time, and B, you want the expert to just do that for you. But it became so dangerous on a public health level that it had to be declared an emergency, especially when it relates to vaccines and social distancing and things that were, you know, found to be detrimental to the spread of COVID, and people either didn't believe it, it came out too quickly, they didn't trust the sources. So because of all of the misinformation, people were either not getting vaccinated or not social distancing or not closing their businesses or whatever it was. And it contributed hugely to the death rate, especially in some countries over others, the U.S. unfortunately being one of the countries with the highest death rates.
I mean, certainly we want to hear experts opinions, but also experts can have their own agendas. I can go on a ramble about this because it rings very close to one of the things I've been reading. It's from my studies that a vitamin has been promoted because it's like this magical pill that can cure aging, but at the same time it's understudied, so you don't really know any other implications. Just because they haven't been investigated, it doesn't mean they don't exist, but this is just adds up to how difficult it is to filter out information and draw conclusions.
And this is like the curse of the scientific community, that prestige is something that matters so much for scientists, many scientists, not everyone. For the sake of their fame and standing, they might not be fully transparent, and that will cause a break between the communication and the trust from the society to the scientists, and vice versa.
That's very true. And prestige in the scientific community is often linked with number of publications. So there's been a deluge of publications that are in fact scientific publications published in scientific journals, but of very low quality. But who knows how to discern whether a scientific study or research study is of high or low quality? Very few people. So you see someone who's piling up the publications and you think, well, they of course know what they're talking about, when in reality, they are just throwing together very poorly done studies to get publications out of it.
That's true. But then how do we like fight misinformation? How do we tackle this problem?
Yes, good question. And it's the million-dollar question. I think it takes all of us. So it takes kind of a society level understanding that A, it's happening, and that B, we are all complicit in the spread of this information, whether we mean to be or not. But, you know, we're all talking and we're all on social media and we're all on the internet. And so, and we, you know, where maybe 30 years ago, anything that I say to someone isn't going to reach you, Elenia, in Greece, or you, Anastasia, in Finland, but now it can in an instant reach the entire globe. So just the rate and reach of the spread is contributing drastically to misinformation. So I think we all need to recognize that it's happening, which I think more and more people are aware of, just because they hear it or because something has happened in their personal lives where they're like, oh, well, I read that and it was completely untrue. And then understand what we personally can do to spread information that is true. Look for the sources. If you don't have a source, don't spread it. Like, you don't have to forward the text. You don't have to, you know, try to get people to believe your opinion because you saw something on CNN. You don't have to be part of this chain of miscommunication. And if you do want to, you know, communicate about public health or whatever the topic is, do take just a few minutes and go see if you can access. If you're reading a story on CNN.com and they say a study showed blah, 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 can you get to the study that they're referencing in one click? And in one click, does it take you right to the study where the study is clearly defined and outlined? And does it tell you who the author was? Because often I'll see things that say, a huge study was done at a prestigious university, which always is a red flag. Like, just say a study was done at Harvard. And if you can't say, you know, if you can't say who did it or where, then I doubt it's that great of a source. And if you're, you know, if you're getting text messages from somebody repeatedly and you question the truthfulness or validity of their information, ask them, you know, oh, where are you getting your information? And just kind of, maybe they haven't thought about it. Maybe, you know, they're just sitting at home passing things along because it's interesting. So question the people around you, and not in a rude or condescending way, but just in an enlightening way. Oh, you know, I would love to hear where you get your sources, or where do you find credible information? And then I think another really important thing is consistency. So especially on the side of health professionals, we have been as a mitigation strategy for the infodemic, saying if you're a doctor, if you're a healthcare provider, if you're a researcher, if you're an academic, an educator, be very consistent about where you get your information. If you have five sources that you know are completely reliable, Cochrane.org, of course, being one, the Mayo Clinic or WHO or the Centers for Disease Control, there are many, but use those sources repeatedly so that when someone hears you say something and they realize that it was true, and then they hear you say something again and later realize that it was in fact true, they'll know, okay, well, this person consistently gets their truthful information from reliable sources. So I think it just encourages other people to look for reliable sources and maybe narrow down what they consider a reliable source from anything they read anywhere to something that they know is, like you said, Anastasia, a lot of things are clickbait. So that's a huge red flag right there. If it's like, click here to find out how you can look 40 years younger, you know, that's obvious clickbait. That's a huge red flag. That's not going to tell you anything truthful.
Yeah. In science communication, we always say that a title that is short, simple, and to the point is always a reliable source to look at. But yeah, exactly. If you have pompous, is that the word? Like, yeah. buoyant words in your title, then it means that you are trying to attract attention. That doesn't necessarily mean what you will state is correct information. But going back a little bit to the medical experts that you touched upon, there's not only the consistency of the sources, because we as scientists also are humans, we have our expertise, and especially in the case of a pandemic like COVID, there was so much new information incoming in every day, you can't know everything. So it is very important to be able to build this level of trust with the society that you would tell them, you know, I don't have that information right now, but I will look it up and I will get back to you. And then the people should say, oh, this person doesn't know, doesn't mean they are bad or non-credible, because exactly they said they will go and search for the information. It means that they will invest the time and the care to pass on the information. And that is very important way also for fighting it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think if you are a prominent figure in your community, you have a little bit more responsibility. So we talk a lot about in some of our workshops about trusted sources, but that can mean different things to different people. They may trust their next door neighbor inherently. They're their best friend. They've been neighbors for 30 years. They're well known in the community. You know, maybe they're elected to the city council. So very reliable person. However, they may not be a reliable source of health information. So it can be difficult to pick through all the minutiae of what a credible source means. So I think if you are someone in your community or in your field of work that does interact with groups of people, you have a little bit more responsibility to ensure that what you're passing on to your target audiences is reliable.
I think I will plead guilty of probably having spread at some point in my life some misinformation I was like, somebody told me, or oh, I think I read this somewhere. But nowadays I often do this. I always put at the end of my phrase, don't quote me on that, or take it with a pinch of salt, meaning that I'm saying it, but I'm not 100% sure for the source.
Please check my own sources.
Fact check me, please. That's what I'm doing.
Me too. Me too. I always put disclaimers like that.
And for us, I think it's a constant struggle as scientists, because usually people are confused, like, why aren't scientists like given very defined conclusions and given us like strict facts? But especially when there is some new data or some new information, it's very hard to give like very strict and very precise statements. And that's why we try to be very careful with them. But at the same time, that's not what exactly what people want. So they want the answer right here, right now. So we have to sort of balance out, especially like here in the podcast as well, like the science communication field, make it very appealing to people, but at the same time, balance this out by being truthful and leaving that skepticism in.
Yes, and you guys have to, you guys do. You're right. Ride that fine line every day you do a podcast episode. You're right. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I wanted to add to that, that sometimes this level of not giving the certain answer, it's something that the society needs to start trusting as the optimal way of sharing the information, because research renews itself by the day, by the year, and things that we have discovered now, especially when it comes to medical research, the better our methodologies and technologies become, the more or the new things we find, and so research renews itself, and it's important to leave a level of doubt. It doesn't mean you are not credible or you don't know your facts. It means you are taking the safe approach, which is, this is what we have found so far, but these are the weaknesses or the unreliable aspects of it. And as Anastasia very nicely pointed out, we need to be stating these things very clearly.
And also maybe for others being a little bit more patient, because science does progress fast, but not maybe as fast as we would wish to be.
It can take time for sure.
But going back to the misinformation, Tiffany, you mentioned at some point that the importance of credible sources, and you did mention Cochrane being one of them. As we said in the intro, Cochrane does systematic reviews on medical-related research. So how difficult is it to review a topic and like make such a systematic review?
It's pretty in-depth and relatively complicated. So systematic reviews take all primary research on a very well-defined topic. So something really specific, let's say, for example, X therapy for a heart condition. And you look and you find, oh, there's 20 studies that have been done in the last 30 years. So we're going to take all of those 20 studies, pull them apart and grade them and look through the evidence of all of them and say, okay, this one showed a really positive effect of the therapy, but it was a very small sample size and not very well done methods. This study showed no effect, but it had a huge sample size, was very comprehensive methods. So you take the studies apart and you see how well done they were, how the findings either corroborate each other or not. And then you reanalyze all of that information into a systematic review. So you're systematically reviewing all of the research that exists on a very specific topic. So depending on what you're looking at, you can, if it's something very new or something a little bit obscure or maybe hasn't been studied in the past, you may only find 3 or 5 studies about that, in which case it's not going to take you that long to review those and reanalyze it. However, you may not get much information because there wasn't much information to find. So in that case, you may have to say there was low quality evidence about X and Y. Whereas in a more topic that's more well known or has been researched for many years, you may find literally hundreds, sometimes thousands of studies on the topic. And those can take up to 2 years if they're really well done and all of the data is extracted and all of those studies are read and analyzed. So I would say on average, a systematic review takes at least a year, especially if it's Cochrane, because Cochrane has the most rigorous methods of any systematic review organization globally. So you have to be very rigorous with your methods to publish your work with Cochrane. But then that's also what makes us very trusted across the globe. We have country offices in 53 countries. And we have 82,000 members of Cochrane in every country on Earth. So it's known as a very credible source. But on the other hand, when it came to COVID and things were changing daily, a 12-month study was not going to answer any questions. It wasn't getting people the answers, or medical professionals wasn't getting the answers to anyone. So Cochrane has actually, I think, along with most organizations in the world, health or not, kind of review how quickly we can get things done. And if there's a quicker way to say, you know, like, here's preliminary data that we can say to help make a decision in, you know, we would only want to do that if it were absolutely necessary, like it was during the pandemic. But it does take a while, but they're super interesting, and it almost always requires a team just because it's a lot of work. And so
yeah,
you get to know your team well, and you get to know your institution's information specialists and librarians well, and really figure out what those people do. And it's been, for me, I've been with Cochrane for 3 years, and previously I was a primary and community level researcher. So my level of knowledge on the rigor and design of primary research has increased drastically.
It sounds like the ultimate peer review, to be honest. Like, this is what the actual peer review should be.
Right, yeah, it's basically that, but on a, yeah, just with, instead of parts, we like to say if we're carrying out a systematic review, like each of the studies that you're including is like a participant. So you have inclusion and exclusion criteria for the studies you're going to include, just like you would if you're doing a primary research study, and you're recruiting participants. So each of the studies is like a participant.
Wow. And also, of course, the research keeps on going, that by the time you publish the review, there will be like some new paper published that would be... Oh.
You're right about how quickly news... So if it takes 12 or 18 months to complete a systematic review, there could be new studies out by the time you're finished. So they do updates of systematic reviews to include new studies that come out. But one of the main goals of systematic reviews as well is to finalize research on a specific topic. So back to my example about the medication for a heart condition, if all of these studies over 30 years have shown that this medication is effective and safe, there's no reason to spend any more money on new studies to randomize people to a placebo group when everyone knows they should be getting the medication, to, you know, spend university resources, not just money, but researchers and graduate students on something that actually has been proven already. So that's one way to kind of, if the evidence is strong, then there's no reason to really duplicate the work on that topic anymore.
Yeah, one can say maybe with advanced techniques, but of course, as you mentioned, like, it with certain studies, yes, that's relevant, but for some, just yeah, let it go. And
exactly,
it's already like hardcore truth.
But what I wanted to say before is, like, I found it very impressive when I was first introduced to Cochrane, the work they do, and how important it is, because I've read tons of books about, you know, how data and, like, in medical research and pharmaceutical research did not do any favor to women because the sample study was male dominated, and they didn't, you know, transparently, or they didn't feel at that time that they have to report all these things. And that had affected people, same also with people, not only women, but also people from different genealogical backgrounds, if that's the correct term. So it's so important to have an international organization looking over and cross-checking similar studies and see what they have fully reported or not, and what are the results, and as you said, how they compare. And it's fascinating. I think more fields of research need something like that, and I don't think it exists in many fields of research.
That's a good question about that. Yeah, I wonder. And another goal of Cochrane is that our systematic reviews are used by guideline developers so that these recommendations can get into clinical practice, that the latest research is incorporated into hospital systems and evidence-based medicine curriculums. WHO, for example, a huge global guideline developer, they use Cochrane systematic reviews in 80% of their global guidelines that they create. So, so they don't just go to like a researcher, you know, who reads this 60-page boring systematic review. They go to practical purposes. And on the Cochrane website, you can search by any topic. It's just a search box. And every study has a 2 or 3 page plain language summary. So there's no need to read full systematic reviews unless you want to. And a lot of them have accompanying podcasts with the author, or they have visual data graphics that accompany it, or there's journal clubs where we pick specific topics and anyone in the public is invited. So there's a lot of ways to access and use Cochrane evidence without having to know how to read a systematic review.
Journal club sounds so cool because if you're not someone from research and medical research specifically, you can just go there and learn yourself so long you're interested. Yeah.
Even from medical research, let's go for it.
Yeah. No, this is, it all sounds like they say music to my ear. It's an amazing initiative and an effort.
Eliana, maybe you'll start an initiative in physics.
Yeah.
It's a good advice, Anastasia. It's a good idea to start something like that. The problem is that because physics has branches that have a direct impact to society, so the research output from them can directly affect our everyday lives. There are other topics which it's more like fundamental physical research, whether it's, inside a big lab or by studying the sun or the, galaxies, the universe, whatever, that it might not spark the interest, and it will be a very, very, very,
dry,
painful effort, to start something like that. There are community initiatives, so there are in certain topics a lot of researchers working on that topic, which they will group together and try to do the work. We also have the International Space Science Institute in Switzerland, in Bern, and it forms groups of experts from different countries where they come and they tackle a specific topic. And it's also a collaboration with the International Space Science Institute then in Beijing. So they do also these dual teams where they collaborate people from the rest of the world and people from China to tackle different issues. But it's smaller scale and it's more manageable. It's not that they do reviews on the topics, like the systematic reviews in that sense. Yeah, no, I think Cochrane is at the forefront. I will say it again, very, very cool and very impressive.
Can I also add to this? Because Cochrane is doing like more of a larger scale reviews, but there's at least one person that I know. Her name is Elizabeth Bick, who also looks very deeply at the details of papers. And sometimes she finds just astonishing ways like with which people just fabricate data. Sometimes they just like have a dish with like these dots.
Like a Petri dish?
All over the place. Yes, Petri dish with lots of bacterial colonies, which look like a disarray of different spots. And then they just rotate it, or like they copy paste a frame into a different plate, and then they say, "Oh, there's no difference," or "There's a big difference."
Oh wow!
And lots of things like this, and they're very difficult to spot with the naked eye. And this is also one more thing that I wish more people were doing, is that because it's so difficult to spot, like even if the reviewer was nice and thorough, unless you spend your days specifically looking at these pictures, just
and then somebody will cite that study because it's a research study. So they'll say, we read in a research study, but it's so poorly done. It's fake.
Yeah. I will not dive into detail, but we had a similar scandal in solar physics this year with fabricated images, and it is a devastating thing to think about. So speaking about the systematic reviews, did you ever experience at Cochrane some backsplash or resistance from authors whose research you have been systematically reviewing, or the public? And how can you manage such interactions?
That's a really good question. We have a communications department that does deal with that, and we try to remain extremely objective, and all of our methods are extremely transparent, published everywhere. And we don't accept money. We don't fund anything. So there's no exchange of money at all in Cochrane. So I think you can complain and say you reviewed my study poorly, but because it's so systematic and methodological, they would have to go through the entire process as well and prove that the researchers graded their study incorrectly, which would take them a long time. And they're usually also not called out study by study. So it's just kind of like, here's the overall data that was found. So it's kind of like a compilation. So it's not necessarily like, ooh, this study was horribly done. It's just more like, you know, out of 250,000 patients total in all of the studies that were done. So they kind of just compile it. So it's harder to call out specific studies or specific authors. However, it can happen. It also can happen that there's backlash to the findings of a study that was a systematic review. So recently, actually, there was a systematic review that came out about masks. And it said that there is low quality evidence to say that masks are effective. And that was extremely controversial because A, the media can take it to mean whatever they want.
Exactly.
So the media took it and ran with it, saying masks are worthless and don't work. And that was, you know, people were like, oh my God, of all groups who could say that, Cochrane would say that masks don't work. But it was just a poor interpretation of the evidence, which was lack of evidence doesn't mean lack of effectiveness. It just means that, and also this was a review about masks and respiratory diseases, and they had studies for like 30 years. So people immediately, when they think of masks, think of COVID, but only a very small subset of their studies were COVID related because they were doing a respiratory disease. So there were just a lot of things that probably should have been looked maybe in more depth at by Cochrane's editorial service. And they're, you know, very willing and transparent to say that that happens sometimes, but also it just goes to show how anyone can take a finding and make it say whatever they want it to say.
That's absolutely true. And it's not only about misinterpreting a result, it's also keeping the parts from a finding that serve your message and what you want to pass on to your followers, in the sense that even the little protection you might get from the mask is so essential. So if there's something that adds a little bit of extra shielding,
right,
to your health in a period of a pandemic, in times of a pandemic, then why complain about doing it? It's like something so small. And in the end, yeah, at the beginning, wearing a face mask is unpleasant, but in the long run, you just get used to it. So, yeah, but I can see how media and politicians could twist these results to their favor.
Well, as we just covered, like, as long as they deliver what people want to hear, that's all they really need.
Yeah. All right. I think we have already touched so many topics, and this was a very insightful episode to me. I really, as I said at the beginning, had no idea that there is a difference between misinformation and disinformation, that even there are so many different words and definitions within it. Definitely when it comes to the main sources of spreading the misinformation far and wide, my guess was that social media was the culprit, or media in general, and not texting platforms like WhatsApp. So that was something totally new to me.
It's a friend and an enemy.
I know, like most things are. Everything in moderation.
Yes. And I mean, certainly for me, it was also very insightful, and hopefully for everyone listening to. And I would say that addressing the issue is already the first step towards solving it. And I think we did it today as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you again, Tiffany, for joining us today and sharing your knowledge on this subject with us and our listeners.
Thank you so much, Eliana and Anastasia. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I really appreciate the invitation. I'm excited to listen to more episodes.
Thank you for the compliment. Yes, I guess with that, we shall say goodbye to you all. Check out our social media on Twitter and Instagram, and you can just type in The Science Basement Podcast, and you will surely find us. Leave us your feedback, comments, share your own experiences. We'll be happy to hear back from you. And otherwise, see you in the next one. Bye.
Bye-bye.